Thank you for joining us today at the Thai Podcast. Welcome to the show. How about you start us off here for the 23 Masters? What do you recall there?
Oh, this is one of the most complicated ones I think we've ever had to handicap. On the flip side of that, the meat pie scene in Australia is
rock solid,
next level. It doesn't feel like maybe a full major, but it doesn't feel like much less than a full major. You agree with that?
Yeah, I'm with you there. I was kind of in the north of 0.6, but maybe south of 0.9, like a 0.8 somewhere in there. I mean, all the analysis aside, like, what is your gut telling you? Are you kind of more in that 1.6 or the 1.4 camp?
I'm kind of more in the 1.4 camp, especially with regard to...
I like that. Yeah, that whole area, Melbourne, King Island, Tasmania, it's hard to beat. So,
Hobart's cool going to be... I mean, yeah, I feel like Hobart's going to be the next spot, right? Between 7 Mile Beach and I think 5 Mile Beach and a couple other things going on down there. And the city of Hobart just sounds spectacular. So I need to get down there in short order.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, well, let's jump into it. We got a hard stop here with a live show coming up, or happy hour rather. So we're talking major values 2.0 today. This is our second rendition. You sit here and kick it around like, all right, so the 2016 U.S. Open that DJ won, like that's not a single major, right? Like he had to deal with all the adversity, absolute banger of a golf course, super competitive event. Like that deserves more than a single major. And then, we'll hold off on the drive-bys here, but there's some PGAs in the past and just different tournaments that you're like, I don't know if that deserves a full tournament. So someone's got to do it. Someone's got to break it down for these different players. How many majors do they really have based on how each tournament broke out? That's what we're here for. But of course, before we do that, we got to get into the dirt. TC, you're one of the best of all time in the dirt. So what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking lately?
We'll start with drinking because I've probably been drinking too much lately between Super Bowl and weather's been really, really good here in Jack's. So kind of been grilling out and enjoying some time at home. I would say drinking, there's a couple things. Darling Wines, my friend Tom Darling, he just came out with a couple new Pinot Noirs and then a new Syrah as well. And those are all three are just spectacular. I've been drinking my way through that shipment here and then trying to be patient so I can put some of that stuff away in the cellar too. And then also just some stuff from the Canary Islands. I'm getting deeper and deeper into that. The Envinate, the Listón Negro was a big revelation for me over the last couple of years. It kind of tastes, it's like a charcuterie board in a glass, if I had to kind of describe it. But I would say from a next level standpoint, there's another one called, and I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It's Iquen or Iquine. It's Ikewen. Even lighter and more approachable and even funkier. But same thing from Gran Canaria. And yeah, so that's awesome. Eating would be good question. I'll throw it back to a place we ate at in Australia called Gimlet. Spectacular down there. Just probably a top 50 restaurant in the world. They were very, very hospitable. One of the restaurateurs there invited us in. And then, but I would say on the flip side of that, the meat pie scene in Australia is
rock solid,
next level. Like there's a place down by Barwon Heads on the Bellarine Peninsula that we ate at that was just blew my mind. We were eating meat pies the whole time, but they do simple food really well there between meat pies. There's so many like banh mi shops. There's just great handhelds there between that and the coffee scene down there. It was spectacular. So
yeah, no, that's that gets me going.
Then reading is next. Reading. I've been slacking on that front a little bit. I think the last thing I read, I was telling Randy about this on one of our pods, is It's a book called Raising Emotionally Strong Boys. I have two sons, a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old, and just trying to get them to be empathetic and in touch with their feelings a little bit and not just wanting to beat the hell out of each other all the time. And as someone who I have a brother, I don't have any sisters. I don't, trying to kind of establish that mold a little bit has been eye-opening for me. So that's been at the top of the list. I'm working my way through that. And then a book called Mindset as well. Kind of some like weirdly some self-help stuff. So I probably need to read some fiction or some lighter stuff down the line here. Thinking. Gosh, hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this because she'd probably kill me. But thinking like coming back from Australia, I keep thinking like, man, when the kids go to college, like I could move there for at least a couple of years. And it's just I just really, really like it down there. Where the people are wonderful. It's obviously it's got its flaws. It's on the other side of the world. It's highly isolated. It's highly like it's a much smaller country. There's only and very sparsely populated in relation. But it's just a highly functioning society. I think people look after each other a little bit better they're just very they're way with words and they're way with everything's in proportion, I think, down there. And it's just really, really cool. And I look forward over the next few decades to spending more and more time down there.
Nice. All right. Well, let's jump right into it. So we're going to go through JT, Rahm, Morikawa, and Nicholas Faudo today. So we've got the two club and then Mr. Six, starting with JT. So, I mean, at face value, you got two PGAs, which is probably not, probably not your best combination, but that's why we got to go one by one here and see, how each one actually shakes out. So we got to start off 2017, Quail Hollow. Two shot win over Francesco. This is going to be a theme today. Louis as a runner up, of course. Patrick Reed in the fold. Ricky Hideki. So, I mean, immediately some things kind of stick out to me here. Like, who out of that list is really going to run someone down? Was he really competing with anybody? He played great, but then I go back on Quail. Quail is a regular tour stop. They firmed it up. They got it harder for the PGA that year. But there are a lot of red flags here on what the actual valuation is going to be. So that's kind of the opening bids there. What do you have to say about 2017 at Quail? What do you remember? What do you think about JT? What do you think about the contenders? What's top of
Yeah,
mind?
I think, yeah, I struggle with Quail. I think, thinking back to 15 years ago when Quail came out on the tour as I think at the time it was what the Wachovia Championship, and the Green Mile. And, it was kind of a breath of fresh air as far as tour stops go. And I remember David Toms, making a quad on the final hole and he had an 8-shot lead going in. That was awesome. But, yeah, I'm a little bit thinking of like Valhalla this year as well of like the major venues are a little bit meh this year. Same kind of thing. My spidey sense is up a little bit with some of these PGA venues here upcoming. That said, I think this was it's a big boy golf course. It probably suits a guy like JT better than most. It's maybe a little bit limiting in that it like it's kind of shocking to look at it and see the third round leaderboard, like the 54-hole leaderboard, was Kevin Kisner was out front, shot 67, 67 to kind of lead it off, and then limped home on round three with a 72. But he was up. You got which it doesn't seem like his kind of golf course, kind of a bomber's paradise there. And then Hideki and Stroud were one back, and Oosthuizen and JT were two back. And Grayson Murray was three back. And then after that, it was like everybody else was five back. So looking at it, I don't think, you got to give JT some credit in that he went and got it. He was two back going into the final round, got off to kind of a bad start in this tournament. He shot 73 first round, as did Francesco. And, like Francesco shot 73, 64, 74, 67. To finish two back. So kind of an uneven week for him. But JT went out, shot 68 and kind of went and got it. But at the end of the day, like you said, nobody really, he was two down, like he was two back of Hideki. through seven holes, and then kind of, I don't know, just kind of cruise controlled home seemingly. Like he had a 2-shot lead by the time he got to, by the time he got to 16. And so I don't know, this one's just kind of like, it doesn't feel like maybe a full major, but it doesn't feel like much less than a full major. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you there. I was kind of in the north of 0.6, but maybe south of 0.9, like a 0.8 somewhere in there. A couple iconic shots. Like he had the hanger on 10, that ball that went in, the chip in on 13 was sick. And then the shot on 17 was just, that was awesome. Yeah. If you recall, it's like a 215, 7-iron, like perfectly pin high, 12 feet, right? Just like absolutely nail stuff. So yeah, I think not a whole lot more to say there. 0.8 feels pretty good to me. Let's roll on to 22. I think that we take a clear step up here with Southern Hills. That was a really good golf course. It was a good event. Obviously, Zalatoris there all the way till the end. Matt Fitzpatrick was part of the storyline. Cameron Young was part of the storyline. A lot of like really good young players. And then it's crazy to think that JT was kind of like the old head there, but maybe we'll call him the experienced head out of that crew. And I mean, it was a massive comeback. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I don't recall the exact margin, but I mean, he was like
7 shots back.
Yeah. So he was not like part of the storyline until he was, you know, I guess they covered it on a Full Swing, how he just made the turn and like was starting to get into it, but still needed to make a really big push. And he did. So he ends up getting into a playoff and he ends up winning into the playoff. And so that was just a fun major. I don't know that I would quite say it was iconic, but that stood out as like a man. That was a real ass event for sure.
Yeah, I think a couple things there. I think Full Swing would have led you to believe that, you know, the PGA Tour goes to Tulsa 7 or 8 times a year.
They sure would.
Certainly, JT would have some comfort level with Southern Hills. I think it was a little bit frustrating to see they slowed the greens down and they slowed the surround, you know, they kind of slowed the surrounds down as well. I think they were pretty worried about losing control of that golf course. I really enjoyed watching this one. It was, you know, far, far different from previous iterations of Southern Hills. You know, the work that Gil and Jim and crew did there, spectacular. I actually went and played Southern Hills for the first time last fall, and I walked back to that tee box that Mito, you know, that they're playing on 18, and just that, you know, both 9 green and 18 green, the amount of slope on those greens is A, insane. And then B, like walking back to that tee box, I'm still kind of wondering, like, why do you hit driver there? Like, why do you know, you just, it's a terrifying shot, but also one where you almost think, all right, just get the ball out there up the left side, and then I'm going to have a 200 yard shot in to a tough green. But as long as you get it up there, you're pretty much assured of making, you know, a bogey really at worst. So I think, you know, JT hit some, I mean, massive shots kind of, you know, under the gun there. I think there's a theme developing, or I think, you know, JT's career feels a little bit underrealized thus far, where, you know, I think he plays well on some of these big, you know, like a little bit wide PGA championship courses where you can kind of pin your ears back off the tee, but also shape the ball, hit creative shots, hit your irons really well. Like he's one of the more creative players in the world. And I think he's one of the few guys that truly has all of the shots, almost to his disadvantage sometimes, where sometimes it feels like, you know, he's going out of his way to try to hit a certain shot when really that might actually be getting in the way. You know, it was like kind of with like a blessing and a curse, right? Yeah, I mean, some of the shots he hit down the stretch there was just insane. And then you see it, you know, there in the meantime, you've got Fitzpatrick kind of not melting down, but not going and getting it. Cam Young was kind of uneven all day. You know, Zalatoris, like I think, obviously, they go to the playoff there. JT makes birdie on the second playoff hole, the 17th, which is, you know, great little hole there. And then I think there's something about a playoff win that you're going to extra holes and, you know, you come from behind. And sometimes after you come from behind, you're almost out of gas after that. And I think for him to buckle down in the playoff and hit the shots that he needed to hit and kind of no doubt it seemed, you know, that one probably takes it up to a 1.1 or a 1.2 for me. So
I'm with you there. That was a really good PGA without a doubt. We kind of threw in the clause last time as well that we did this, that like the players is never going to get a 0.6. It's never going to like augment where you're at, but it can kind of solidify. And so like we led with like the two PGAs, like there's kind of some stuff in the air there, but second one being a really solid event, having that players to kind of be the bedrock there. It's like two feels like a really solid number for JT. Before we move on to Rom, to take one out of your playbook here, 3.5 is the plus minus for JT on the career. Where do you go?
I'm going above. I'm going plus. I'm going over. I think, again, he's what, like 30? Is he 31?
2011 30? High school grad, 18. What are we on, 24? Yeah, 31. Something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like he's got great golf in front of him. I think he's motivated. I'd like to maybe see him distance himself from his dad a little bit, just on some of the professional side of things. Like, I think he kind of needs to be his own guy, and I could see him maybe being a little bit suffocated there. But yeah, I think he's one of the few players in the world, like I said, that truly has all the shots and just needs to steady the putter a little bit. And he seems to be back on the upswing now too. Like, he's a much better player than he's played, you know, really over the last, 12 to 18 months. So, yeah, it's weird, because you would think like his game would suit Augusta to a T. But you know, I'm sure that's coming at some point. Also, one other thing I'd like to call out about the 2022 Southern Hills PGA was, I mean, Tommy Fleetwood shot 5 under coming in to finish, two shots back, but just another spot of yellow on Tommy's Wikipedia page. That,
mustard,
you
know, man.
He just stacks up top fives in majors. It's coming. He's going to win one of these things.
He'll get the green one at some point. Oh, good stuff. Okay, let's move on to Rom. I'll let you do the Masters first after this, but I'll lead us with the U.S. Open here. So, I mean, once again, who's in second place? Louis Oosthuizen. So immediate red flag, because it's like, all right, you're not competing with anyone to win there. To put the numbers out. So Louis obviously won the 15 Open, 6 runner-ups in majors and 2 third-place finishes. That is just righteous. 9 top threes and only 1 win. It's just unreal. In my mind, realistically, he beat Colin Morikawa. I think he was 3 ahead of Colin at the end. Rory is right there, but I hate to say it, but you know, over the last 10 years, it's a little bit of that Louis thing. It's like, are you really contending to beat someone there? I don't know. Brooks was like, he was there. He kind of poked his head up a couple times throughout that final round. He got within a couple a few times, but I don't know. That didn't feel like one that Brooks was going to win to me. He was 2020, 21, he was pushing that territory of like, listen, like you have absolutely maximized what you've done the last handful of years in majors. And so the odds that another one was going to go his way felt really slim to me. So that to me makes it kind of interesting. It's a U.S. Open. I think that Torrey, like it just rides off of 08, like 08 obviously being such an iconic major. It feels like Torrey is a really iconic major venue. I think it's a great tournament venue. But comparing it to many other U.S. Opens, it's probably not our best one. But I guess what I'll finish with is, like, you can't really take away from Rom the way he finished that tournament, making the putts on 17 and 18. Like, he went and snagged that thing. And it was time for him to win a major. And when he needed it, he did it. So I would struggle just starting out to go below about one full major here. But it doesn't feel like one of those U.S. Opens to me that you're starting to push that like mid one sort of range.
Yeah, I think it's just feels like a solid U.S. Open. I think Torrey's overrated, if anything. I think this tournament probably proved that, with guys hitting it all over the lot and almost having better angles. I distinctly remember Bryson, you know, just absolutely spraying the ball and being left in better spots, or you know, not having to contend with certain bunkers. There's that place is just so underrealized. And I think looking at the third round, like I love looking at, like, when a guy won, who was he going against after the third round? Who was 54 hole leader? You got Russell Henley, Mackenzie Hughes, Oosthuizen up there. And then you got Bryson and Rory two back. And then Rahm, Scheffler, Wolf three back. Zadenhout, Morikawa, Schauffele, and Streelman four back. And I mean, really, it looked like this thing was Bryson's to lose. I mean, he was in total control. I think he had a one or two shot lead, you know, through 62 or 63 holes. And then, you know, Rahm just stays afloat, like 9 through 16, some of those up and downs, some of those iron shots. And then, yeah, like you said, 17 and 18 just comes in and completely snatches it. You know, Harris English kind of floats up to the top there at the end. I don't think, I mean, Koepka was there, but it felt like maybe too little too late from him. This one feels like it got away from Morikawa. Rory's kicking himself and Bryson's really kicking himself. I mean, he finished 9 shots back of Rahm after they were tied after 11 holes on Sunday, and he finished 9 shots back of Rahm, which is crazy.
I forgot that clearly because he wasn't even like on my note sheet here. That's incredible.
Yeah. Like he made that, I think he made a quad on 17 there. So it's a little bit misleading. Like he was
right.
You know, he doubled 13 and then he made a quad on 17. But yeah, I don't know. One of those things where the manner in which he did it was impressive, but also, you know, I don't think Torrey Pines is a legendary or a, like you said, Tiger winning there definitely bumps it up in the public consciousness probably higher than it should be.
It works for tournaments. The tournament year in, year out is interesting. I actually was there. I didn't play. I was doing other things in the area, but I had some friends that played about 7 or 8 days ago, both good golfers, like scratch plus handicap golfers. We went and had dinner at the club after, and they were like, that was not fun. Like, I did not enjoy playing that golf course. And I think that kind of speaks to Torrey, you know, like it works for a PGA Tour event once a year. It's fun to watch those sorts of guys play, but you know, when you're a plus two and you're walking in and saying like, yeah, 86 times, you know, it's just like, I don't know. I'm not a huge Torrey fan. What's your number on this one? 1.1.
I think one. Let's just leave it at one.
You know? I think that's solid.
I don't think any need to overcomplicate it. Right.
Agreed. How about you start us off here for the 23 Masters? What do you recall there?
Oh, this is one of the most complicated ones I think we've ever had to handicap, right? Because it's, on the one hand, it's Masters. Everybody was coming in playing well. You've got, you know, like it truly felt like, all right, the golf world's coming back together. And, you know, how's Cam going to play on the heels of him defending, you know, or on the heels of winning at the Old Course? How, you know, what's going on with JT? Is, you know, is Morikawa the real deal? Like, there's all this kind of stuff percolating in the background, and I think the weather just put a damper on this one for me. Like, it didn't feel, you know, we've had a couple of these in recent memory, right? We've had this one where they're essentially playing on just a complete, almost unplayable, soaked golf course. You got trees falling everywhere. And then you've got, you know, the one in 2021 where, you know, they're playing in the fall. Is that 2020 or 2021?
That was 2020.
2020. Yeah. They're playing in the fall.
Is the Jim Nantz video.
That doesn't necessarily feel like a normal Masters either. So yeah, I struggle a little bit to handicap this one. Just and the fact that Phil finished runner up, it's just kind of
something in the water.
I still don't think my brain has like fully wrapped its head around that. That said, I think, you know, like Brooks looked damn near unbeatable through 3 rounds, or through, I would say, 2.5 rounds. He shot 73. You know, third round, but you know, so did Rahm. Like, everybody kind of struggled that day. That was just like a get it in the house and survive kind of thing. I mean, like, looking at the 54 hole leaderboard, you got Brooks, Rahm, Hovland, Cantlay, Henley, Matsuyama. But you know, Brooks has a 2-shot lead over Rahm and a 6-shot lead over Henley and Matsuyama. So got Sam Bennett up there, Morikawa. They're both seven shots back. And it's one of those things that just, you know, it felt pretty early on Sunday like it was going to be a two-horse race. And that's kind of what, you know, bared itself out between, you know, Rahm and Koepka. And then Rahm kind of asserted himself, you know, didn't get the birdie on two, but asserted himself relatively early, you know, birdies three and then just, you know, birdies eight and actually bogeys nine, but he's two up at the turn. And by the time they get to, you know, 13, after 13, he's five shots up on Koepka, going to the 15th tee there. So one of those things, it felt like he just played flawless golf and he did what was in front of him and he did what he was asked to do. So this one also feels, you know, it's an impressive win. And I think this one feels like a one to me, just like Rahm has two majors. He won over really good leaderboards on very difficult golf courses, but golf courses that may be a little bit flawed as well. So those two things kind of cancel each other out.
Yeah. The right combination of US Open and Masters can like really, really augment that number. But I agree with you that, you know, Torrey is Torrey. And then this one just felt funky. It's funny how these things work. Like if he had come back to him a little bit and had to fight it out with Koepka late, it almost feels like that could add the value. But he was just like, it was almost underwhelming to watch because you knew by the middle of that back nine, he was in such control. To me, it was the shot on 13. I mean, he just hit like the tightest draw, obviously as a guy who cuts the ball, tightest draw on 13 right down the middle. And I was just like, that was kind of his opportunity to maybe do something silly, 12, 13. And he's just playing immaculate golf. There just felt like there was no chance that anything was going to go wrong. And so, again, it's kind of convoluted to say that takes away from the value. But, you know, this is a convoluted game we're playing here. So that just is what it is. I'm with you there on kind of one, maybe just over. He feels like just a two major guy to me.
Yeah. Even just thinking Mickelson shooting six, going 75, 65 on the weekend. Yeah. I don't know. I think Rahm is obviously, like, I think he's going to be a force at Augusta every year now that he's kind of cracked the code on it just because the putter is so good. And, you know, the iron play is so good and he just doesn't seem to have, you know, granted he's hit those shanks here of late, but I think once he gets back in that kind of cauldron again, it's going to reinvigorate him a little bit. So
quick shout out to Phil. I'm in the midst of the Billy Walters book right now. I've read Phil chapter last. It's really good. And I read the Phil chapter last night. Wild, like numbers I would not have ever guessed from the gambling standpoint. Like we're talking placing thousands of bets per year. Like there were certain days like where he was competing on tour, placing 30, 40 bets on MLB baseball, all of it. Hundreds of millions of dollars, potentially billions of dollars wagered over time. And just like the types of bets, like the number of, you know, minus 110 games that he's just betting the house on, stuff that's like not even that fun. Anyway, craziness. All right, let's move on here. We got to keep it rolling.
I would love to know if Phil ever got deep into like WNBA betting or like Russian hockey, you know, stuff like that.
Had to. He's spent a lot of days down at the Del Mar racetrack just like betting on random horses. It's just, God, what a guy. Okay, Colin Morikawa. This is where things get pretty interesting. So we got two like full-blown COVID majors here. So starting with the 2020 PGA at Harding Park. So another one where it's just like, who was he really competing with? So we got Paul Casey. That was just never going to happen.
Complete non-factor.
Paul Casey. Doesn't count. Dustin Johnson, like, okay, he counts.
Paul Jason Casey's Day, like a non-player character.
Like he's, right. Like he just like doesn't even, he's there. He's going to finish in the top five or so. He's not going to win the golf tournament. It's just not going to happen. Jason Day, Bryson Finau. I mean, come on. Another kind of Paul Casey sort of figure there. Wolf. There was also a pre-dog era Scottie Scheffler. So, you know, that probably factors into it. But like it's not like saying Scottie Scheffler these days, right? Like any Scottie Scheffler being part of the storyline this year is a big deal. 2020 PGA, probably not quite as much so. This was like the full-blown COVID major. There's nobody out there. Harding Park. So I personally like Harding Park probably more than the average person. I've got the chance to compete out there a few times. I think it's quite a good golf course, but yeah. I know some people go a different way. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I've only played it twice now, and I felt like I was not going to like it. I felt like it was just going to be a monotonous slog of long par fours and pretty nondescript greens. There's more stuff going on than you would think.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I think it's a good tournament course. It, you know, kind of forces these guys to work the ball both ways. The par threes are cool. You know, I do think there were no fans at this one. Like you said, this was, you know, a COVID major. So there's no buzz, right? There's nobody tracking, you know, when Morikawa is tracking somebody down or when somebody's tracking him down, there's no like, you know, murmurs across the property, right? So I think that's a little bit, maybe takes it down a notch on the one hand, but on the other hand, like this feels like one that got away from DJ, right? I mean, yeah. DJ was in total control of this thing. He had a one-shot lead over Cameron Champ and Scheffler. Paul Casey and Koepka and Colin are two behind. And then Berger, Day, Bryson, Finau, Fleetwood, and Rose are all three behind. And from the get-go, I mean, Dustin, I think he dumped it in a bunker. Like, I remember being really bummed on Dustin, like pretty early on. I'm just like, oh man, it's gonna be that kind of day. Like, that's, you know, that sucked. And then obviously the shot on 16 that Colin hit, which is like, all right, like he went and got the damn thing, right? I mean, he was 6 under in the final round to win by two. It's not like Dustin played poorly. He just really didn't, you know, like really didn't have his best stuff. I don't think, you know, and it was kind of one of those things where there really wasn't anybody else that was going to go and get it. Like Morikawa ends up winning by two, and it's, you know, there weren't a whole lot of dogs in the mix, if I'm putting that bluntly.
Yeah, no, totally agreed there. In terms of handicapping this one, like, I don't know that we quite have to pull out the double rounder here, the 0.45, but I don't know that he even quite scratches out 0.6 or 0.7 on this one. To me, this is in that half major sort of territory. COVID, you know, makes a big mark. And then just the lack of dogs. Like, so 16, like, I kind of go both ways on that as well. Unbelievable shot, iconic for the tournament, great stuff. But it kind of shows that whole time it was like, any one of those players is just one shot away from it happening because no one else was going to really take that thing from him, you know? So,
and there's not that much downside risk with that shot either. Like, he hit the shot, but like, if he doesn't hit the shot, he probably tries to get up and down from the bunker, right? It's not like it's truly do or die. You know, so I think I could be talked into like a 0.75 here. But I'm fine if we want to go 0.6. That's how it works.
Let's table it until we do what we do with the Open Championship, and then we'll kind of see where that sums him up to. So 2021. Obviously, we skipped the 2020 Open Championship for just COVID complications of getting guys across the pond, all the craziness there. Royal St. George's. I think that's a golf course as well. This to me is like kind of true. I kind of have this take that there are certain Open Championship courses that people are like, like, you know, that Troon's kind of overrated. Troon's pretty sick. Like, Hoylake's overrated. Hoylake is pretty sick. Royal St. George is pretty sick. I think they're all great, frankly. Maybe that's just the novelty of it all. But when you actually get out there and see the things, like, I've yet to see one in the Rota that I'm really like, you know, that one's kind of not on par with the rest. But people can do with that as they may. Spieth is your runner up here. So that's an interesting one. Like, Spieth post, you know, 2016, 17 now.
Be careful. That's here. Just, I'm a Spieth homer.
Oh, I know you are. And I love the guy to death, but he just breaks my heart on a daily basis. Once again, who comes in third place? Louis Oosthuizen back again. So no competition there. My main recollection of this one was, I mean, kind of as advertised, like you got Spieth. It's like, is this going to happen? Everyone wants him to win, but is anything really going to happen on this? And then Morikawa was just nails. I mean, I recall just incredibly good driving play, incredibly good iron play, just absolutely diced that golf course in terms of fairways and greens. And that you know, took away from it a little bit. Like, we all wanted to see Spieth do something fun and make a run at it. But Morikawa was just, I mean, he was the best player in that tournament by a pretty solid margin for my money.
Yeah, I totally hear you as far as the reason why the Open Championship is my favorite major. It's definitely a variety of reasons, but one of them is there's no bad venues. Lynx Golf rules. Like, to me, this is probably my least, like, I've never played it. I'd love to go play Royal St. George's. It looks like a freaking delightful romp. For me, from a viewing perspective on TV, especially, this one to me is the one that is the outlier to the rest of the open roto courses. Like, I would much rather see him go back to Lytham than go back here. Just with regard to, you know, it's in Southern England. It's, you know, you got great dunescape there, but in a way that it makes it more of an aerial game, which I think obviously favors Morikawa. I think there's, and this was just such a toothless tournament. Like, he was
what, 18 under, 19? It was pretty low.
He was 15 under, but like,
okay,
didn't, you know, shot 67, 64, 68, 66. You know, Spieth shot four rounds in the 60s. Like, there, you know, Mackenzie Hughes shot four rounds in the 60s. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of downside out there. You still got to go hit the shots and get it done. But, you know, to me, it's like part of the reason I love the, you know, like, when typically when you get a benign open championship, you're also looking at, hey, it's baked out and firm and fast, like Tiger at Hoylake kind of thing. And like, hey, there's not a whole lot of downside risk, but man, you gotta manage your golf ball because it's gonna run into, you know, bunkers that you didn't even think were in play because it's, you know, the ball's just, there's no friction out there. And this kind of felt like maybe the worst of both worlds in that front, where, you know, some of the, you know, and there's some blind shots, there's some stuff going on there. Again, some of that stuff doesn't really shine through on TV quite as well. You know, I'm sure it was a great one to watch in person. And yeah, you know, it was just, he went and got this one. I always call him kind of the dome golfer, right? When the conditions are somewhat benign, like, and you're playing kind of track man golf, Collins are pretty good at that, right? I'd like to see a little bit of wind, a little bit of variable thrown in. So that's why I'm going to knock this one down a little bit too. This one to me is like a 0.75, 0.8.
I think we're in the same camp here. It's like both of these feel like 0.7, 0.8. They probably keep him right on that 1.5 line. So he's going to round up to 2. I don't feel that we can quite dock him below a rounding to 2 majors. But I think he's that, like, squared off too.
I feel like you said 0.6 though. I feel like he's right on the line of, like, if it's 0.6 and 0.8, you know, we might be at like 1.45. He might be rounding down to 1.
I mean, all the analysis aside, like, what is your gut telling you? Are you kind of more in that 1.6 or the 1.4 camp?
I'm kind of more in the 1.4 camp, especially like with regard
that.
To...
I like that.
You know, he's looking at his other wins on tour and you know, he won the Workday. That was the one at...
Two Workdays.
Yeah, 2 Workdays, really. But the WGC one... Yeah, I don't know. I think I struggle with it because I think Colin should have more on his resume. You know, obviously some of it's due to the putter or to, you know, various kind of, you know, heating up, but he's not a dominant driver of the golf ball. You know, one of the best iron players in the world. But yeah, I don't know. I'd like to, for motivational purposes, I'd like to put him at 1, you know, or like, you know, have him round down to 1. I feel like that's, you know, it's two majors with asterisks on them. You know, doesn't feel like 2 majors, right?
I'm with you there. two COVID majors, two workday events. He's a COVID guy. He's a workday guy. He's one major guy. And now a quick word from our friends at Good Walk Coffee.
Dude, I've been getting a lot of questions recently about the magical fruit.
Big blueberry?
Nope, I'm talking beans here. Coffee beans.
What do people want to know?
Where to get a steal on quality beans shipped to their doorstep. Do you have anything?
Absolutely. A company called Good Walk Coffee, based in California, roasted in North Carolina. Great beans, nice people, excellent variety.
Are they a steal though? People want value.
Oh, I got the steal for you. Use code THETIE, that is THETIE, at checkout for 20% off any order.
So that puts us around $1 per day for two cups of quality coffee. That's below market price for quality beans. Where can I send them?
That's exactly right. Send them to goodwalkcoffee.com. Tell them the Tie Guy sent you. Once again, that is code THETIE, THETIE, 20% off any order at goodwalkcoffee.com. Moving on, Nick Faudo. This is an interesting one. So I wasn't alive for any of this. I guess you were, but probably not exactly. I don't think in 1989 you were exactly watching TV. I could be wrong. But so we've got the 89 Masters, the 90 Masters, the 96 Masters, the 87 British, the 90 British, and the 92 British. We'll go through these. I think the first thing that stands out to me, kind of having to really research this wasn't as much off of, like I said, there's no memory here. So I had to really kind of dig in and get in the weeds on these. So obviously three times at Augusta, he won two British Opens at Muirfield and one at St. Andrews. So from a pure golf course perspective, just like really, really interesting stuff there. I mean, clearly
top shelf.
Yes. He likes the great venues and competed in them quite nicely. Okay. 89 and 90 Masters. I almost kind of put these two together. So goes back to back, which is good stuff. Both of them were tight. Both of them were won in playoffs. 89 over Scott Hoke with Ben Crenshaw and third leg Greg won back. Shockingly, Norman bogeys 18 to miss the playoff. In 90, he wins over Ray Floyd, who had won the Masters already at that point. So to me, that goes somewhere. Those two are way ahead of the rest. And I think the most interesting thing about 90 is he's four back with six to play and ends up minus three through the last six holes to get into the playoff. So, and this will be something that we talk about as we go along here with Faudo, but people talk about that his nickname was El Foldo prior to him really winning a bunch of majors. But then when I get into his winning season, like he was a dog when he started playing well, like other people on Sunday when Faudo was in the mix, they did not turn up and play very good golf. And I think to me, that goes a long way. So let's start with those two. Then we'll get to 96. We'll get to the opens, but 89 and 90, a couple playoffs, didn't play amazing golf necessarily, but he just kind of outlasted people.
Yeah. I think in, 89, he shoots 65 in the final round, like, but it's kind of wild to see a 77 on the card, for his third round there. Yeah, again, like I need to watch these. I haven't watched 89. I think I've watched 90 before. I've never watched the 89 one. That's probably good homework to do. Like I feel like this one could be its own pod episode because I feel like Faudo's career is probably pretty vastly underrated.
Yeah.
You know, like really even beyond, like, you know how much I love national opens, right? The guy was stacking up Irish Opens. He won the Dunhill. He won the, the Volvo PGA. He won big time, French Open. He won a lot of big ass national opens overseas. He also lost the US Open in a playoff to Curtis Strange. Now granted he got his ass kicked in the playoff there, but and then on top of that, his PGA Tour wins outside, like he won the six majors and then he won the Heritage, he won at Doral, and he won at Riviera. Those are like top shelf wins. And radically different golf courses, right? Doral versus Harbortown. I'm not sure you can get two more opposite spots than that.
Yeah, totally.
Right. I think that like there's so much to unpack here, and I struggle because I think this is like I'd love to like go in depth on kind of how he won them and how they developed from round two to round three to round four. My recollection too is like he won them different ways, right? He won with you know, he won by 5 or 6 shots, you know, over Norman when he was way down going into it. And then he won, you know, at the Old Course by 5 shots and, you know, kind of on cruise control. And then he won from coming behind and he won in dogfights too. So he won kind of every which way as well. Where I think the totality of it, like you know, you kind of look at, all right, let's, you know, let's say that like I feel like the Masters kind of balance each other out. Let's say one was maybe against a weaker leaderboard, coming back against Norman was also like makes up for any of that. And then, you know, beating Ray Floyd at Augusta is pretty heady stuff. And then, you know, looking at his Open Championship resume, like I think that freaking speaks for itself. You know, there's just such a, you know, beat Zinger, and I'm not familiar with Roger Davis's game, but, you know, beat Payne Stewart, Mark McNulty, and then John Cook and the other one. But two at Muirfield, one at the Old Course is strong. So I think once you get above like 3 or 4 majors, it becomes like the decimals become so much less important, right? It's just like, all right, the totality of it is, all right, maybe it's 5, maybe it's 7, but at the end of the day, you're still like in the upper echelon of major winners ever, you know, being at 6.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that like 96 is one that's interesting to me. Obviously he's 6 back to start the day. Your top 3 in that tournament, you got Faudo, Greg Norman, and Phil Mickelson. Talk about a fig jam group of 3 players there. But yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to think through that in terms of Greg Norman being 6 ahead to start and losing by 5. Like, was he ever going to win? I don't know. This is the one that it felt like he had to. The whole, you know, the documentary is pretty good. I guess the Masters to me, with 2 playoff wins, that one, to me, that shakes to about 4, like a rounding to 4 probably. It could be just a square 3. It's not 5. But I feel like that's about 3.5 in there, just the way that he ended up doing it. I also have a lot of respect. Obviously, it's not like cat sort of stuff, but the fact that he wins one in 89 and 90, takes some time off, then gets back to it in 96, you know, 8 total years separating the wins, I think is pretty impressive. And then, yeah, I mean, the British Open, like it's just 2 at Muirfield and 1 at St. Andrews is just nail stuff. Also of note, the 87 win at Muirfield, 18 pars on Sunday to win the thing, which is just awesome. And it, you know, it takes you back to the days
of major like Muirfield.
Yeah. And it takes you back to the days where major golf was just like that, so that went a long way, you know, anymore that 18 pars on Sunday, unless you have a 7 shot lead, probably doesn't do anything. And it's just like, it's awesome to think about that. Like, how fun would that have been to be able to watch that in person or on TV?
I think there's also something inherently impressive about a guy coming over and, you know, like playing most of his golf in Europe and then coming over and winning 3 Masters and not playing over here a whole lot, like, you know, exclusively, where versus, you know, it seems like a lot of the guys who on the European side, like Rom, for instance, he's come over here, he's came over here for college, he's lived here, da 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 da. Like, it's nothing to parachute in March or April, play some Florida events or play Heritage or whatever, play, you know, play the Masters and then kind of be ready to rock. And like, I think that takes a little bit more gumption too, right?
Yeah. I think my biggest takeaway here, like I'm kind of with you that, so if I were to give it a number, like I kind of broke this down, it's like 7 to me. I think it just the golf courses, it's just really impressive stuff. My biggest thing, it's easy to give Faudo a lot of shit. I think most people or many people do at least. But when you really break down his resume, kind of like you said, it is absolutely nails sort of stuff. Like the major record, the way that his career developed over time, the sort of player that he turned into to go from a guy who was long and wild and was known to really crumble under pressure to be this guy that's out there just like making 18 pars on Sunday and, you know, as like soon as he gets in the mix in majors. Player. Yeah, just like running people down and like you said, winning in different ways. I might have to take a little inspiration there on you talking about a deep dive on Faudo's major career, because this is really impressive stuff. You know, it's easy.
Like, I think we do like those, you know, deep dives, like KBV did the deep dive on Gary Player. And I think he's in a similar camp to Gary Player where he, like Faudo's seeming, you know, he's been married, what, four times now. He's said, you know, he was not great in the booth, in my opinion, but I think we've almost let some of that stuff sour our opinion of who he was as a player. And player was the same way, right? Player's like, holy shit, this guy was so good. And like, I think that this would be a great candidate for like KVV to do, you know, because it's the arc of his career is really impressive too, with kind of rebuilding his swing with Ledbetter and you know, kind of saying, hey, good, you know, very good's not good enough. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just very, very complicated, you know, kind of textured career, I think. And like, similar in my opinion, like a VJ, right? Like kind of maybe not the most likable or maybe a little bit prickly, but you know, got shit done when it mattered.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We're in a good spot there. TC, we got to get you out of here in just a moment, but let's finish up real quick here with, do you have players in mind for an over and underachiever? Who's your biggest over and underachiever in your recollection major wise? I don't know if you really gotten the numbers here, if you're just going straight off the gut, but what are your two callouts there?
Yeah, I would say Spieth is probably my underachiever. Just because I feel like he's won like half a dozen Masters. You know, it's just like I can't wrap my brain around the fact that he's only won it once.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
You know, so that's probably my underachiever. I would say my overachiever, and this isn't, you know, props to him for winning the tournament, but Jimmy Walker. I think I would maybe ascribe that like a 0.2 or a 0.3. We've been over that and everything. I think one guy that I'd like to shout out for, you know, he won the proper amount, but I don't think people respect him enough for it. Like everybody talks about old Tom or, you know, young Tom for that matter, you know, some of the other guys on that front. I think James Braid is like one of the most underrated golfers and sportsmen of all time. Like, you know, dude won at Prestwick. He won twice at St. Andrews. He won twice at Muirfield, I think. Like it's, and he was beaten up on Varden and some dogs, J.H. Taylor. So I think there's, and I love his golf courses too. So I think Braid winning 5 open championships in a span of like 9 or 10 years is remarkable. And then traveling all over the British Isles and, you know, designing golf courses before, during, after that is sweet. So I think Braid should get more historical notoriety personally.
Those are really good shout outs. Just really quick here, kind of on the numbers side of things. I had Zach Johnson. I mean, he had one other top 5 in majors.
Man after my own heart.
And to walk away with an open championship at St. Andrews and a Masters with one other top just 5.
Just devastating.
Highway robbery. Angel Cabrera, only 4 top 5s in majors. Similar, a U.S. Open at Oakmont. Maybe the last like real major we're ever going to see, winning at +5 and a Masters. You know, that's pretty strong stuff.
That said, though, Angel, like he was in the mix. Like when he was in the mix, he was in the mix. There's no stolen valor yellow on that.
Fair enough. Yeah, yeah. Underachievers, I mean, it just has to be done. Rory, 4 wins, 17 top 3s. Like that's tough stuff. Louis, we've talked about him a million times. And then I think the objective data-driven answer here, and this has nothing to do with recent stuff. It just is what it is. Greg Norman had 20 top 3s in major championships and he won 2 of them. He had 8 runner-ups. I mean, it's just brutal. Ernie would also get a tough scene there on the number side of things, but Ernie played fully through the Cat era. And so, I mean, there's a great case to be made that all else being equal, if you take Cat out of the equation, Phil wins a dozen and Ernie wins like 9. And you know, that's just
DJ probably sort of wins stuff. A few more too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something there with, you could almost say that underachieving, like Tiger and Jack could be up there, all the runner ups that Jack had. And then, you know, Tiger was beating up on plumbers and firemen for a while there as well, especially in like the mid 2000s, you know, if not for some self-inflicted injury stuff. And you know, like there's something, I think there's something to be said for Tiger, you know, probably should have won about 20 majors.
Yeah, plumbers, firemen, and a degenerate left-handed gambler. TC, a blast as always. We'll be back for more. Appreciate you coming on, and we'll let you go.
My pleasure, Henry, always.